This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, Amazon grocery stores hit Trader Joe's and cannibalize Whole Foods.
Plus, we learn how buy-side traders navigate through new rules, Brexit, and ESG.
But first, let's take a look at the bond market and the Fed. Last week was a tremendous move in yields. What are the key things to look for going forward? Joining us now, Ira Jersey, a Bloomberg Intelligence rates strategist. Ira, in the broad scheme of things, where should yields actually be on the 10-year?
Yeah, so our models show that 10-year Treasury yield should be around 1.6, 1.65%. So more or less 20, 25 basis points above where they kind of averaged this last week.
All right, Ira, bond prices up. Yields down. I get that. I am a little surprised at how low these rates are. How much is really fundamentals versus maybe some technical trading in the Treasury market?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. So one of the big kind of both technicals and fundamentals that's going on is that globally, yields in a lot of other jurisdictions where there's a lot of savings are exceptionally low and in many cases negative. So you look at yields on Japanese government bonds, and for a lot of them, they're until you go out to about the 10-year, they're negative. So, you know, would you rather be buying a 5-year Japanese note at negative 10 or 15 basis points, or would you rather be buying a 5-year U.S. note, you know, at a positive rate? So, so there's a lot of demand coming from overseas investors, which quite frankly had gone away for the better part of 5 or 6 years. So it's now coming back because you have this dynamic of low yield just about everywhere. And part of that is fundamental because even though the U.S. is recovering quickly, a lot of other countries are still well behind where the U.S. is in terms of recovery. So so you basically have this search for yield, and also the dollar has been doing okay during this time because U.S. growth has been somewhat better than other countries, and that's been supportive of Treasury yields.
What would it take, I guess, then, to get that extra 25 basis points higher from what your models show that the 10-year yield should be trading at?
So I think there's a couple of things. I think the big one is for the Federal Reserve to actually start tapering. So,
like, you know, say the word or like actually do it?
Well, they said the word, and once they said the word, remember what happened after the June Fed meeting when Chair Powell said, this was the meeting where we talked about tapering, and as soon as he said that, 10-year treasuries were off about 10 basis points. So, you know, basically once we have a definitive time frame from when the Federal Reserve is going to start tapering, and once they start actually doing it, I think that you could have treasury yields significantly higher than they are today. Now, you know, our scenario, base case scenario, was that 10-year yields are going to go over 2%. We've tempered that a little bit, primarily because of this rally. And this rally does feel very technical. You know, Paul asked a second ago how much of this rally has been technical. I think a fair bit has. A lot of people like us were expecting yields to be much higher. So when you didn't get higher yields, people covered their shorts. They were in steepener trades, and they had to get out of those steepeners. And because of that, you saw the bond market rally and the yield curve flatten a little bit. And a lot of that technical, I think, is out of the market. So now the question is, what's the next technical impetus for yields to go up? And I think that at this point, it has to be the Federal Reserve to actually start, announce that it's going to start to reduce its asset purchases.
Does the current Treasury market, where the yield is right now, again, it's called a relatively low yield, does that tell you that the market's saying, hey, these inflation numbers, they really are kind of transitory?
So a little bit. So the way that you break out where the 10-year Treasury at, you know, call it 1.5% for a round number, you look at the inflation component of that, and then you look at what we call real yields. And they're driven by two different things. So real yields tend to be driven by things like the Federal Reserve asset purchases, growth expectations, so the expectation for how GDP is going to go, as well as volatility in that growth, those growth numbers. And that's been very, very negative, and historically, at historically negative levels for basically since the coronavirus crisis began. And, you know, that can go from here to zero. Now, what the 10-year treasuries, the 10-year tips are telling you is that inflation is going to be around, you know, again, round numbers, between 2.25% and 2.5%. And that kind of number says, okay, that means we're going to have high inflation now, a little bit lower inflation in the future, but still not runaway inflation. But still, we haven't yet taken out the reflation trade out of the market. You know, there's been some headlines suggesting that the bond market's where it is, reducing the reflation trade. That's not true at all. It's actually pricing more for stagflation than it is for a lack of inflation.
So, but we're still seeing stellar growth. I mean, even if Goldman downgraded their growth forecast, it's still 6.8% or something crazy for this quarter.
But it's not growth now; it's growth in 2022, and so the market is thinking about kind of out year growth slowing significantly. Because when you think about some of the sectors where you see higher prices, it ends up being in a way a tax on the consumer. So when you have higher prices for things like medical care or for some goods that are traded from overseas, that leaves less money for things that grow the U.S. economy, such as services.
All right, thanks so much. Bloomberg Intelligence rates strategist Ira Jersey, always a pleasure.
Coming up on the program, we find how Amazon grocery stores are hitting the competitors like Trader Joe's.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, in case you don't have enough Amazon in your life, Amazon is now opening grocery stores. To get more color on that, we bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst Jen Bartashis. Jen, to be honest with you, I was not really aware that Amazon is opening actual stores. Give us the laydown. What are they doing?
Yeah, so, you know, Amazon currently has about 14 of these stores open. So it's still the very early days. But really the strategy is that Amazon wants to be part of the food landscape because people buy food all the time. And although a lot of people buy off of Amazon all the time, this is a way to really get entrenched in a lot of households. And they've discovered that they can't do that only online and that they need a physical store base as well.
Didn't they buy Whole Foods?
They did buy Whole Foods, but they haven't done a lot with Whole Foods, actually, in the years since they bought it. Nothing has really materially changed. The store base hasn't gotten a lot bigger. They've added a few stores, but they haven't really grown sales in a remarkable way. And part of that is the niche market that Whole Foods operates in. And so these new stores are much more mainstream, with mainstream brands and that sort of thing, so that the appeal is to hit a broader audience than Whole Foods.
All right, this cannot be good for competitors out there. If I look across the street and I see an Amazon opening a store and I own a Trader Joe's, I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. I know you did some work on this, what the competitive impact can be in local markets. What did you find?
Well, what we found is that is based on the 56 locations that we're aware of, so there are 14 that are open, 21 under construction, and 20 more that are still in the pipeline, that if you look at those on aggregate and you look at where they're located, Trader Joe's is the most exposed to all those locations with 8% of their stores falling within a 3-mile radius of just those 56 Amazon stores. So what that really tells us is that Amazon is targeting a lot of similar demographics in terms of household income, population, that a chain like Trader Joe's is also going after. And right after Trader Joe's, the next biggest is Whole Foods and then followed by Sprouts Farmers Market. So they are all kind of the ones that are poised to lose the most.
What's remarkable about Trader Joe's, though, is just how cheap stuff is there. Like, their brand stuff is insanely cheap, like worth waiting for online for an hour cheap. And Amazon can definitely undercut the best of them when it comes to price. Can they go that low on Trader Joe's?
Well, Trader Joe's is, you know, part of the allure is that they have these, you know, these items that come and go, right? So you want to get them while they're in the store because you don't know when they're going to be there again. And the prices are very compelling. But for other people, when you're just looking for your everyday shopping needs, Amazon has the scale to really undercut other local players. And so that's where the threat comes into some of these more traditional grocers, in that Amazon can just keep lowering prices or not raise prices and make it a really difficult competitive environment.
You know, you mentioned earlier that they want to be in the food business. And I'm like, what I understand, and partially from reading your research, it's a really tough business, low margin business. Why would they want to be? I don't understand the Whole Foods acquisition. I don't understand the need to be in the bricks and mortar business when their entire multiple and their entire stock price performance is based upon e-commerce and this thing called the cloud. Why do you want to own a grocery store?
In truth, Paul, I don't think they ever want to own a grocery store that's got 3,000 locations, you know, but having a physical store builds awareness with people who, you know, may not be using Amazon for groceries. And when it comes to grocery, it is a tough business. Margins are terrible, but it's high frequency, and it is still one of the few categories that are out there that is underpenetrated from an e-commerce perspective. So when you compare it to books or electronics or any of those other things that Amazon has kind of conquered, they still see food as a huge opportunity, and that's why they've been going after that. But physical stores play more than one role. So people go there to shop, but they also become mini distribution centers that can be leveraged for home delivery or for online orders, for curbside pickup, things that some of Amazon's competitors in food have done very, very well at.
So people actually still go to a store and buy food and walk out with it?
A lot of people do.
What? No, I'm kidding. I do that too. But to be fair, I actually order food online quite a bit. So then what does that wind up meaning for Whole Foods? Like, I understand that Amazon's going to be going after a different kind of market, but there's going to be overlap. I mean, I'm going to be an overlap customer. So, like, what are they going to do?
Yeah, there's definitely some cannibalization, is what we would say, in terms of Whole Foods and Whole Foods sales with these new Amazon Fresh stores being opened in close proximity. So the product mix is going to be very different. So even if you are a shopper that prefers, say, organic produce, you may still want to buy Oreos. And so there will be a slightly different product mix that you wouldn't necessarily find at Whole Foods that you would find in these Amazon Fresh stores. And then from a practical perspective, they may also be able to gain some distribution efficiencies by having stores located close to each other, if they're able to actually, you know, do their supply chain well, you know, they could be looking at more efficient distribution and saving costs that way.
Are you surprised, or is the market surprised, that Amazon hasn't done more with Whole Foods, or maybe gotten bigger and bought a bigger supermarket chain?
Well, you know, when Amazon bought Whole Foods, everyone thought that it would revolutionize the grocery industry. And instead, it kind of just revolutionized Whole Foods, and not necessarily a way that resonated with all of its customers. I think there's been surprise that Amazon hasn't done more with Whole Foods, because it did have such a good value proposition for the customer base that it catered to. And by trying to change that customer base, which is really what Amazon has sort of done with Whole Foods, it's alienated some shoppers. And I don't know that if that's actually, if there's been an offset with enough new customers who are attracted by the Amazon prospect of coming to Whole Foods to offset those that they may have alienated.
Oh, that's interesting. And then I think that maybe that's then explains a little bit of the Amazon stores, because if you move that kind of like distribution thing that I've seen in Whole Foods, where, like, how, you know, a third of the store is made up of these Amazon shoppers, except if you move that to a distribution store and make that more of like a factory, you can like recreate the Whole Food experience where you get to wait online and try cheeses and you know, look at the different cookie display, you know what I'm saying, like that fun part.
Yeah, and if you've been in a Whole Foods recently, you can barely navigate the aisles sometimes
totally.
A day, because there are so many shoppers in there filling online orders. So if there's a way to offload some of that traffic out of the store as well, then that could improve the experience at Whole Foods as well.
All right, Jen, thanks so much for joining us. Jen Bartasha, she's a senior analyst covering the food industry for Bloomberg Intelligence.
All right, coming up on the program, we're going to learn how buy-side traders navigate through new rules, Brexit, and ESG.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
If you're a buy-side trader, you've had a lot to deal with in the past couple years, and a lot of that comes in the form of new regulation. You got new rules, new trading requirements. You got Brexit. You have ESG and the complexities around that. So let's break it down with Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Regulatory Asset Manager and Market Structure Analyst Sarah Jane Mahmood. Sarah Jane, walk us through. I just kind of outlined a couple things, but how hard is it to be a buy-side trader right now?
I mean, it's been a really difficult year for buy-side traders with changes in regulation, particularly around the ESG area, and also a lot of uncertainty with Brexit around the exit date on December the 31st. And obviously, political negotiations there are continuing throughout this year as a deal really hasn't been reached. But we interviewed 87 traders at the largest European asset managers responsible for over £28 trillion in assets. We conducted an online survey and also one-to-one telephone interviews. And generally, I found that they coped with all of this very, very well. And that's mainly due to long-term contingency planning with Brexit since the referendum back in 2016, but also emergency regulatory relief around Brexit, and also a lot of cost that was poured into dealing with changing regulation and ensuring compliance with that.
So, Sarah, I'm just wondering about Brexit. It was such a big issue, and it continues to be in terms of where are the big global banks going to allocate their trading desks and things like that. What are you finding in terms of how this is evolving?
Well, again, I think that with Brexit, they've managed the disruption very, very well. A big plus that we've found is that late December, when it was clear that perhaps a deal wouldn't be reached, it was pretty easy to shift flows via sophisticated algorithms and also put into play emergency contingency planning measures. But regulatory uncertainty does remain the most disruptive risk factor for most of the traders we interviewed, along with further flow fragmentation. There's, again, a lot more concern, I feel, among the medium and the smaller sized firms that we spoke to, because obviously abiding by a dual system, one in the EU, one in the UK, pushes up costs significantly, and it makes it a lot harder for these smaller players to scale up.
The one thing that hasn't been as telegraphed, if I go to something like ESG, how are asset managers and the traders and all of that, how are they dealing with this?
With ESG, the overwhelming focus in Europe has been on the portfolio management side with the EU Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, the EU taxonomy that's been widely spoken about. So there's a lot of regulation that investment managers have to stick to on that side of the buy side. But on the trading floor, there are not really such strict rules at the moment, but I think there will be going forward. ESG is pretty much in its infancy on the trading floor. But speaking to all of these traders, I get clear signs that ESG is slowly influencing the trading process and trading strategies. ESG has been cited as a top team priority for many, and a lot of traders we spoke to, they do already have processes in place to measure counterparties' ESG profile, like diversity and carbon footprint. But also importantly, looking at the wider picture, ESG itself in Europe is likely to have much more of an impact on assets under management this year than in years gone before, with overall an estimated 27% jump this year compared to only 12 last year.
All right, Sarah Jane, I hate to do this to you, but I have to ask a MiFID II question. In my opinion, just my personal opinion, this is a solution in search of a problem. But briefly describe for our listeners what MiFID II is and why it's a big deal for the financial institutions over in Europe.
Sure. We're talking about MiFID III now, actually,
oh boy,
which you'll be delighted to hear
Thank
about.
Thank you.
The UK regulators just launched their review of MiFID II, looking to change a lot of the regulations, including the share trading obligation, which has been quite controversial, and to lift the double volume caps, basically the restrictions on dark trading. The EU regulators are likely to release their MiFID II review in the next few weeks, definitely by the end of the third quarter. Again, looking at what to do with the share trading obligation, where you can trade euro quoted shares, what to do with dark trading, and also what to do with research. And we've spoken a lot about the research unbundling rule and whether or not it should be further softened at this late stage. A number of the traders that I spoke to said, you know, it might be a little bit too little too late. But definitely among the smaller firms, there was a lot of support for the SME exemption that comes into play next year, but also on the fixed income side as well, which does suggest that the smaller firms are struggling a little bit adapting to the new rule, because obviously they have to absorb the costs of research or pass them on to clients, which isn't quite attractive.
Oh, God, MiFID III. all right, thanks a lot. Sarah Jane Mahmood, a market structure analyst, asset manager, a senior regulatory analyst as well for Bloomberg Intelligence.
All right, coming up on the program, we take a look at the mid-year outlook for global exchanges.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
When big banks report earnings, they talk about the immense turnover in trading revenue, equity trading, FIC trading, etc. So what does that actually mean in the back half? If trading has peaked for big investment banks, what does it mean for the actual exchanges? Joining us now is Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior financial analyst, Paul Gulberg. What was the first half like for the exchanges? What's the second half going to be?
The first half was very decent for the exchanges. You had very strong equities. Obviously, a lot of equity strength came from retail in the first quarter. But we are seeing some of the switch to more reopening trading in commodities, and more volatility in the interest rates with potential upside eventually next year or year after. So second half is going to be quite better versus the first half.
Talk about the comparisons here. I'm thinking that the comparisons, as I think back to 2020, crazy trading volume, which is good for the exchanges. Is that going to set up some comparison difficulties?
It is. So if you look at the full year, a lot of the revenue comparisons are going to be relatively flat compared to the full 2020 versus 2021. But if you look at the second half versus the last second half, as most of the very volatile trading was left in the first half of 2020, you are going to see some momentum.
Who's trading? And I guess I'm trying to get some insight into if you get a read on retail traders through the exchanges. Or it's probably too tricky, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit tricky because, first of all, when we're talking about the retail traders, I think we have to qualify that we're talking about U.S. equity trading, right, and
sure.
U.S. options trading, because we are covering global exchanges and a lot of it is institutional. So we're talking about really three exchanges, and NASDAQ, Cboe, and Intercontinental Exchange, the owner of NYSE, and then a handful of trading venues like Virtue, Susquehanna, Citadel, they do execute the trading. So we had a tremendous spike in January and around the first quarter from retail trading regarding the GameStop and related stocks. And it kind of came down. It moderated quite a bit. Retail trading, our market structure team estimates about 20% of overall trading. So it's still very active, but it's down from the crazy levels we've seen in January, February. What I would also notice around retail, that the bulk of retail activity actually goes off the exchanges. It's executed away from the exchanges by the companies that I mentioned, like Virtue and Citadel, rather than NYC and NASDAQ.
So, Paul, in the past, we've seen in this space here some consolidation. Are we going to see more M&A going forward?
We're probably going to see some M&A. Last 2020 was extremely active. The first half of this year is a little bit more slower than we've seen. But again, I wouldn't be looking for a tremendous transformative deals where one exchange would be buying the other. We've seen some market data and analytics deals like iSpy and mortgage business, LMA, and obviously LSC Refinitiv deal closed, and they're now one company. But he's probably going to be one of the few.
Something that we've heard over the last couple of weeks is China kind of cracking down on its companies listing out of China and IPOing outside of China. Maybe the idea is they're going to IPO within the country. And so what kind of activity can we expect going forward in that respect?
It's kind of interesting as well, because the U.S. also has an issue where we're trying to demand more disclosure from the Chinese companies in particular, and a lot of them could potentially risk delisting. So Hong Kong actually probably going to be on the winning end if U.S. or China tighten up the regulation.
All right. So, again, that's kind of where I wanted to go a little bit, just the regulatory framework here. On a global basis, it seems like there might be getting a little bit more tight on some of the regulatory frameworks. I know with the Biden administration, perhaps a little bit different view than maybe the Trump administration. Is there any concern in the marketplace about that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of view from Gary Gensler's SEC in terms of potentially more regulation on the retail side, on the retail trading side, as it's obviously one of the premises of SEC, and they do see quite a bit of risk and kind of gamesmanship in that area. And there's probably going to be some of that to come. And they're still in the U.S. and in the U.K., there's a lot of pressure on the regulatory side to reduce the cost of data for the market participants.
All right, Paul, appreciate the update. Looking forward to more. Paul Goldberg, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Financial Analyst.
All right, let's talk about construction. You think about reopening trades, and construction kind of sounds like one to me. What does that mean for these big construction equipment companies? For more, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Industrial Analyst Chris Cialino. All right, Chris, I'm thinking the big tractors and the big construction stuff. Is that going to be in demand in the back half of this year?
Yeah, so absolutely. We think we're still in the very early innings of a heavy equipment recovery. We're seeing an inflection in non-residential construction leading indicators over the past couple of months. You have tremendous pent-up replacement demand, particularly with aerial equipment and mining equipment. Inventories remain tight and will likely continue to be so moving into next year. And we have the most promising prospects for an infrastructure bill in recent memory. So the demand backdrop remains very favorable, and we think that could really set the stage for a multi-year recovery in equipment demand for Caterpillar, Deere, Terex, and the other heavy machinery producers.
What are they going to build and stuff? Like, you might have the equipment makers are selling their products, but the people that buy them, like, what are they making? Is it bridges? Is it houses? Is it, you know, like, what's the thing?
Yeah, so if you look in North America, residential construction has been unbelievably strong. That's been kind of the one bright spot within North America. China has been another bright spot internationally. But like I mentioned, we're starting to see non-residential spending pick up. You're starting to see the rental companies, which are big consumers, a lot of the heavy equipment, start to place orders and really ramp up their spending. So it's starting to be a little bit more broad-based and kind of branching out from a lot of the residential strength that we've seen thus far.
Hey, Chris, we've heard in lots of areas of this economy supply chain problems, like the auto industry. They just can't get cars on the lots. What's it like in your side of the business with those big construction equipment companies?
Yeah, the machinery sector is certainly not immune. The supply challenges have been broad-based, but I would say for the most part, they have been managing the disruptions better than a lot of the auto or truck manufacturers. We haven't seen production lines come down for the most part, and the supply challenges kind of vary day to day, but Caterpillar, for example, went into this year with a little bit extra inventory in anticipation of a little bit stronger demand backdrop. So I think that has also helped cushion some of the supply challenges as they're able to meet some of their customer demands. It will certainly be a problem, or I should say a production constraint for the balance of the year. We're still continue to see demand outpace supply. But we think that's really a positive as we move into 2022 because we're going to have some of this unfilled demand that will really spill over into next year, which even in a flatter-ish retail demand environment, you're still going to have a restocking story that should unfold in 2022.
Do they have pricing power, these companies?
They do. If you think about construction and mining machinery, there's really only a few large global competitors, Caterpillar being the big economic bellwether. Komatsu is also a large player in the space. Even if you look at some of the smaller subsectors, really there's only kind of two or three major players. So they do have pricing power. You're starting to see mid-year price increases this year to help offset some of the commodity inflation. We're thinking price cost neutral this year is probably kind of a best case scenario for most of the OEMs, but that should certainly be a tailwind as we move into 2022.
Chris, we've all seen commodity prices go up. That got me to thinking that, gee, maybe mining CapEx might pick up, and I know the mining area is pretty big for the in your space as well. How's that vertical look for the big construction companies?
Mining capital spending, we're just looking at consensus expectations of about a 20% increase in 2021. And now, again, this is coming off a relatively low base from the pandemic. But mining equipment, the age of the fleet is at a record old level. We're looking at spending to kind of go up to the highest level since 2015. And you see that kind of reflected. That's really being driven by all the commodity inflation that we're seeing, whether it's copper or steel. Commodity inflation is very positive for machinery producers. Even though you'll have a little bit of a cost pressure initially, it's unbelievably positive for the consumers and the customers on the equipment side. So the likes of Caterpillar and Deere, I mean, they welcome a more inflationary environment.
Yeah, no doubt. We mentioned a lot of the different verticals, as Paul was pointing out. Which company that you cover is going to benefit the most from all of these? Like, what's the top pick?
Yeah, so Caterpillar is certainly one of the biggest beneficiaries, whether it be from an infrastructure build. I mean, just given their scale, their expansive dealer network, they have a complete product offering. So that really positions them well to capitalize on a higher infrastructure or non-residential spending environment. But also aerial equipment producers, so like Oshkosh, Terex, those are other beneficiaries as well. And they also have the added kicker of we're just entering a replacement cycle for aerial equipment. Mm-hmm. That equipment typically gets replaced every 7 years. We are beyond that point now, so we're really looking for not only the replacement tailwind, but also potential higher infrastructure spending moving forward.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Chris Ciolino, a Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.